Hi everyone, I'm Jonathan Ciboni, founder and CEO of Luxury Insight, the leading data intelligence platform for luxury brands. Every 2 weeks, Godfrey Dini, Global Editor-in-Chief, and Olivier Guyot, Editor-in-Chief Friends of Fashion Network, interview the people who shape the industry of luxury, fashion, and beauty. Our guests share their personal journey and opinion on the current state of the market and what to expect for the future. You can find all episodes on luxuryinsight.com, social media, and wherever you want to listen to our podcasts. We hope you're going to enjoy this episode.
Good day, everyone. For our latest podcast with Fashion Network and Luxury Insight, we're going to be speaking about a key subject, the buzzword of maybe 2023, artificial intelligence and its uses in retailing, luxury and fashion. And we have the good fortune today to have as our guest Mikhail Mass, who is the CEO of CMAPS, which is a very innovative French company, but multilingual, multinational, which is based on the idea of using AI to help find locations for multiple businesses. If that's correct?
Yes, that's correct.
Well, but good morning anyway. Nice to meet you, Mikhail.
Good morning.
How did you first get the idea of this concept?
This concept didn't come from me. The idea came from a request I had from a client while I was a data science consultant in South Korea. It was a client working for a luxury brand, and that brand was planning to open a new flagship in Seoul.
And, where?
In Seoul, South Korea.
In Seoul, okay.
Yeah. And they wanted to benchmark four locations for their new flagships and see what would be the difference. So I did this mission as a data science consultant, and the path I followed was to try to get as many details as possible regarding each potential locations in terms of what brands you have nearby, what is the retail mix, how premium it is, the population, the number of people that might be coming to that venue. Who are they? How many are they? What is their income level, diplomas, interests, and so on. And based on that, it was possible to make a benchmark with numbers, say, okay, this place scores higher than these others, and why? When you look at the detailed stats, you get the explanation.
That requires a certain amount of sleuthing, of really finding the evidence to put together your benchmark. Where do you get that sort of information? I mean, traffic, type of consumer profiles?
That's a whole journey. To get access to that. So usually you start to search on Google and say, okay, like Korean population statistics, where can I get all the amenities, all the stores, etc. Normally you start with like very high level figures, but that's not detailed enough to take a decision. So if you want to be serious, you need to go like really granular. You need to go to street level and even building level. And to get access to this information, for example, to have the income level of people for each building or building block, at least, this is possible through different approaches. So you can get access to the detailed database from the Korean government, for example, which will share a lot of information about their population. You can get access to the income level from the real estate prices, from real estate websites, for example. And I mean, when you have these two informations, like the retail environment plus the detailed demographics, then you start to have something.
Okay. How do you judge if your success suggestions are successes? I imagine the client will come back and say tell you how happy they are. But
yeah, they have a good feeling.
Yeah,
they have also advices coming from their estate agents usually. But like, I mean, the ultimate validation is to wait for like 2-3 years and see if that source got was profitable. Did it achieve the objective expected? But I mean, normally it's really coming from can you make a connection with between your numbers, the numbers provided by you, and the gut feeling of your client? I mean, there will be difference. There will be a difference, but you say, okay, this is what I was thinking, but actually, like, having more detailed information allowed me to take a decision. I was hesitating between A and B. I was going in favor of B. Finally, I will go to A. Like, the difference was not big, but like, when I look at numbers, actually, it just make it way easier to take a decision and also to convince everybody on the table in the organization that this decision is a relevant one.
Okay. Mm. But I suppose what they're really looking at, if you're talking about luxury brands, is a certain performance per square meter, a certain retail performance.
If you look at like the P&L of a flagship, it doesn't need to be profitable as flagship creates visibility, and a lot of your revenue is going to come from e-commerce as well. So you have a presence in a place where it will bring up your brand image. It will bring up the awareness of people. People will buy online. Mm. People will buy in the store. But at the end, what the P&L has to be on the territory level. So you have to see, okay, this zone, this area, this neighborhood, is it profitable or not for us? And then when you compute the P&L, it has to be at area level, taking in account all the marketing costs and the real estate cost. So it really depends on your business.
But so much of the success, surely, of a flagship depends on making them destinations involving important architects, works of art, activities in the store nowadays, which is something you really can't control.
Oh, you mean like what form will take the store?
Well, yeah. I mean, the ultimate goal is always to make your store into a destination if you're a luxury brand.
Yes, right. For luxury, how many percent of the success of a store will be related to the location, and how many percent will be related to the form that took the store? I mean, normally, when you work with luxury brands, the standards are pretty high. I think it's like 50-50. If you're talking about a well-known brand.
Now, you began this project. This idea was, you said, someone approached you in Korea. What were you doing in Korea?
Originally, I started my career in Taiwan, working for a life insurance company.
A
life insurance company, specializing on data. Like everything related to data mining, like marketing campaigns and so on. I was dispatched to Korea to help the Korean team build a data infrastructure. And then I decided to stay there and to work as an independent data science consultant, which transformed itself into a consulting company. That was like 10 years ago.
Okay. Mm. You're from Bordeaux. Tell us about your educational path.
I my high school degree is science, but when I went to the university, I decided to study literature, philosophy, history, in what we call a preparatory class to go in a school or to become a university professor. So I was specializing in literature. So I completely switched. And then actually after 4 years of study in that field, which was super interesting, I decided to switch again and go back to computer science. So I joined a university in Paris to have a computer science degree. And following that, my first job was in Taiwan. So I was hired in Taiwan to work as an engineer originally.
At what age were you when you went to Taiwan?
Could you repeat?
What age were you?
I was 24.
Ah, okay. Very young.
Yeah.
That's quite adventurous.
Yeah.
Now, tell us about creating this organization, CMAPS. How did that come about?
Okay, so CMAPS is a software that helps organizations take decisions about their business locations. So it started in 2017. Originally, it's only a software only working in Korea. So you have a map. When you log in, you can get statistics, you can benchmark, you can take decisions, but only for the Korean market. And I think starting in Korea was really good because it helped us to be very meticulous, to be very detailed oriented in terms of data. And then in 2018, we got funded from French investors who wanted to do that globally. So of course, you can't build such a deep platform globally in a day. It takes time. So you had one country and then you had another. So we added France, we added Taiwan, we added Japan, we added Switzerland, we added Spain, Germany. I mean, every time we had a request from a client who said, okay, can you do that in the UK? Okay, let's add the UK. So you have to search for the data. So it takes time. But at some point, we started to have a pretty wide coverage. At the moment, we have 40 countries. I mean, most of them.
And clients in all those countries.
And clients in those countries. Yeah. So what is helps our users is really they log in the platform if they want to get details, information, and take a decision regarding expansion in a certain country, like, say, for example, in India, in Vietnam, in Argentina, in the US, in Canada. Everything is ready. So they have detailed information, which was curated by us, which takes a lot of time to have it ready. And it's not only information, but it's also the ability to, this venue is successful. Now I want to replicate it. And you ask the tool, can you find another place, country-wise, which have the same features, the same characteristics as these successful venues I opened or my competitor opened. And then the tool will try to find like the same identity of a place in terms of, so it can be in terms of traffic, what kind of people are visiting this mall, what kind of brand mix you have there, how premium is it, also regarding your existing venues. Is it rational to be there? Or will you create some kind of internal competition and shoot yourself in the foot?
How do you mean creating some sort of internal competition?
Internal competition, like in the our clients' jargon, you have two kinds of positive and negative. Sometimes they want to do it because they want to put at the top the brand image. And like even maybe their profitability will be lower, but like the strengths of being in a certain place will get higher. So they want to have internal cannibalization. They call it positive one. Sometimes it will be bad for profitability and not create an additional image.
You mean creating two proper boutiques in the same city?
The absurd example would be to have two flagships in front of each other.
How do you warn them about that?
Oh, this can be computed. You can compute that.
Really? How?
You can see where people are going and are they visiting? Let's say you have one mall here, one mall there, maybe separated by 500 meters or 1 kilometer. That happens often. Sometimes like completely different people. People who visit mall A, they won't visit mall B. And sometimes they also visit they will visit mall A in the morning and visit mall B in the afternoon. So. Yeah, you need to know that. You need to here, like it's far apart enough, so it won't cannibalize ourselves.
My experience of wandering around important capital cities or major cosmopolitan areas, that there aren't that many luxury areas in those cities. If you look at Paris, there's kind of the Faubourg Saint-Honoré and there's Avenue Montaigne, a little bit Saint-Germain, you know, but it's not as if there are 10 areas. Mm-hmm. So your advice is often, is that right, tends to be limited to a limited number of areas.
Yeah, first thing you want to know is like, where are the big hubs? You arrive in the city which you're not familiar. You want to know the big hubs. Second, you want to understand what makes them different, what makes them unique. Mm-hmm. And then you want to zoom in. Because even if you're from that city, even if you know there's hubs and you know that they are different, within one hub, actually, you have a lot of different places. The number of people passing by is going to be completely different. The profile of the people there, depending if you're on the right side of the street or the west or the left side of the street, is going to be significantly different as well. In terms of number of people, it can go from 1 to 10 in terms, you know, tenfold. So
it's on the same street.
On the same street. So, for example, in Manhattan, when you take like Fifth Avenue, if you're on the east side or the west side, depending on how far north or south you are, it's really, really different. It's not just
20%. In the low 50s or in the mid 40s or kind of nowhere. Yeah. So you're able to provide that data.
We have that up to 20 meters. Yeah. That's also a way to negotiate your lease. You know, like when you discuss with a landowner and you say, okay, you provide this price, but I just compared with another option and like the footfall is really better than yours. So yes, mate, I will take it, but you have to provide a better offer.
In luxury, there are, in a sense, two extremes of business model. The first kind of global designer brand in the modern era, I often think, is Pierre Cardin, who licenses his name and everything. But ultimately, probably the biggest fashion luxury brand in the world is Chanel, which controls its distribution fairly ruthlessly. You know, and basically wants to have a large network. And most people have tried to follow that business model of Chanel in the last 20 years. How do you think AI will affect that business model, or will it not affect it at all?
AI is going to have a better use of capital. The effect is going to be that because you can compute, you can calculate in advance how relevant is the place according to your plan. Then you have a lot less draft decision, if I can say. Then nobody will say it's drafty. But in reality, when you want to dig like really deep, at some point, you know that you need to go in place A and not in place B. You need to work with vendor A and not vendor B. Yeah. If you dig deep enough, it takes just a lot of time. So if you have to do it for 1, 2, 5 places, it's okay. If you have to do it for 100 or 1,000 or more, if you're, we are talking about maybe indirect retail, for example, you don't have time. So if you can have it prepared for you by the tool beforehand, and just get a summary and just get like the top relevant vendors to go, you save a lot of time and you reduce a lot your risk, and then you increase a lot the efficiency of the capital.
Can you speak about some of the fashion brands that you've worked with? Do you work with LVMH group brands?
Yes.
But you prefer not to mention individual clients?
That's right.
Okay. How big, what would be the biggest luxury brand you've worked for? Which annual sales roughly?
Within the LVMH group. I can say which one.
But yeah. Substantial.
Yeah.
Much. And what is the payment structure? How do they pay you?
We have a SaaS. We are a software as a service. So they get access to the tool for a year over a certain territory, which can be a couple of cities, an entire country, several countries.
Yeah.
Then they can just get access to the basics, just like I want to know pedestrian traffic, I want to know demographic, or I want to get access to advanced capabilities such as, okay, I have, let's say 3,000 vendors in that market, and I want to do a deep analysis and try to understand what makes them unique, what makes them, how can I regroup them in terms of family? How can I help them? How can I help them boost their sales? You know, maybe by adjusting the format of the corners I have there. So it really depends. I don't know if you want to have some numbers, but basically, this is a tool which is easy to use and you're autonomous on it. We have professional services which can be provided by our partner on the luxury consulting. We have a luxury, actually, it is Luxury Insight, I can say it. They will help the users on the brand side to like bring the tool to its maximum limit. So get the max value from the tool. So you don't want to spend a month understanding in detail how you can get all the value out of that tool by yourself. You prefer to ask an expert on luxury to do it for you. Yes, you will have access to the tool. Yes, you will be able to modify what they did, like adjust them, adjust to new strategy of yours, for example. But like the data loading part will have been done by Luxury Insight, for example. So it really depends. Actually, most of our clients are 100% autonomous, but it depends how much time you have. It depends what resource you have in your team.
How many people work for your company?
We are 12 people.
Okay, 12 people. And you're operating in 40 markets in multiple languages then, I would imagine.
The tool is in English. The tool is in English.
Yes.
And our clients work in English, except in Taiwan. We have some clients that don't speak English, but we do speak. We are three people speaking Chinese. In Korea also, we have some users who we speak in Korean with them. We have two staff in Korea, two staff in Taiwan. So, but normally we work in English.
Globally, how many clients did you have in the last year?
You mean?
Total.
We have 25 organization, and each organization can have up to 30 countries. So 30 teams. For example, our biggest clients, we have 30 teams. So it's like one team, one country. So then, yes, it takes quite a lot of time for us to do the training, but that's okay. So far, it's fine. It works well.
To do the training, that means you're training people for those companies how to use your tool.
Yeah, we do. So it takes 1 hour and a half to do the basic training, and then 1 hour and a half for the experts, like the advanced features of the tool.
And I see you in reading your site a couple of times the word isochrone popped up. It's like a buzzword. What do we understand by that?
An isochrone is a travel time area. So it's, for example, how far can you get if you walk 5 minutes, if you walk 10 minutes? You have two options when you do this kind of analysis. You can do like, we call it flyby. It's like maybe 1 kilometer radius. Mm. Or you can do travel time. Travel time is a lot better because, you can know exactly where people can go. And where, in terms of accessibility, and accessibility is one of the most important thing when you want to open a venue. If you compute in terms of travel time, like where can people come from, where can people go to, it can be just for your store, it can be for doing deliveries as well. That's super important. Time is money. It can be people time. They don't want to waste time in the transport when they come to your venues. And you don't want to have, delivery services going all over the place in a not optimized way, because it's very pretty expensive, really expensive when you do e-commerce, for example.
Okay. You're talking about travel time. I remember that was an obsession of the promoters in Miami, talking about the Miami Art District. It was going to be the new shopping area. I've never been very convinced But the fact it turned in, anytime I go there, it always seems very empty. What's your experience of that? I mean, I mean that was a market where everyone talked about this would be the new area where people shop, but I still feel everyone in Miami goes to Bal Harbour. And do you think sometimes there are districts that people predict will be the future and that turns out to be a mirage?
We have two use cases. Number one is existing ones. We have two use cases. We can see the number one use case is you want to benchmark shopping malls. And maybe the shopping mall owner will share some numbers with you, but do you trust them? Do you want to spend time to ask him? Or do you want just to check the numbers? So we have the pedestrian traffic. We have the population pool around it. So then you can benchmark easily. Second thing is about the future. Let's say you create a new mall out of nowhere. Will it attract traffic? You can compute, you know, just based on all the existing malls. Do you have space for when a new one? And where? Okay, this can be computed. After, will it work or not? No idea. Honestly, we, like a new traffic driver, our clients, they tend to open where you already have traffic, and then we have IKEA, we have we work with the big furniture company with a big traffic driver, and for them it doesn't really matter. They open somewhere and people will come, but this is quite quite an exception. Like most of our clients, they just look at where are people going and they benchmark and they take a decision.
So they tend to follow the general consensus very closely.
Yeah.
It's not like if we build it, they will come.
Yeah.
Tell me a bit about what you learned in your career path that you now apply and what you do at Sempass.
What I learned is like when you do a market analysis, this is very hard. No matter, I'm not talking about computer. I'm just talking about understanding just the business, the environment. It is complicated. Even if you have all the information you need on the table, you have too much of it. And it's quite hard to be synthetic and take a decision. So on the other hand, you need to have a very detailed picture of your market, of your environment. And like you have kind of two things that are kind of hard to conciliate together, like a lot of information, but at the same time, you don't want to draw into that. And at the same time, you want to stay synthetic, stay high level, but you don't want to build something on nothing, on emptiness. Yeah, so this is really difficult to connect, like to plug these two constraints that are super important. How you can do it is just a lot of work. Like you don't have a silver bullet for that. You have just you need to do it with a lot of hours of work, step by step. At some point, you know that you have enough quality. You know that it's good. Okay, you're on the right side of the barrier and you can take a safe decision.
And you're giving good, honest, intelligent advice.
Yeah.
We've a lot of young people listen to this podcast who want to get into the fashion luxury industry. What would be a couple of pieces of advice you would give to someone that going into college now who is considering a path in this area?
In the luxury area or in the technology?
Both.
You need to be super good at the understanding of the strategy, the business, the identity of brand. So 100% business, you need to be 100% business and you need to be at the same time 100% an engineer. This is hard. I don't think there is a shortcut. You need to be super good at each. And then make a connection between the two. But if you are business but not an engineer, and if you're an engineer without being a business, you're going to hit into some troubles, I think. And how you can get it, I think it's just a lot of work. I don't say we are there yet, but I mean we like just looking back, I think we achieved some result as of today. We are not we are not perfect, but we reached some results, and there is no magical way to do it.
Speaking more generally, why is it you think France or French managers, executives, or creative talent have this ability to kind of nurture over a very long time, you know, generations and centuries, even luxury or brand prestige product brands? It's so clear compared to all its great rivals. Why do you think France has that specific skill better than anyone else?
It's a hard question. first thing that could come to my mind is, if you look back 4 centuries ago, the brother of Louis XIV, he brings shoes, red shoes, everybody wears red shoes in the day after. I think it's really about prestige and like the history of France. With a very strong monarchy and such a high prestige of the king, even if it's a long time ago, it still has some echo today. And the second thing is, excellence. If you want to be a writer, if you want to be Marcel Proust, if you want to be Jean-Sébastien Bach, it's a super long way. You can show, it will take an enormous quantity of learning. And I think this kind of exigence has been in some way applied to the luxury world. So maybe it's related to that. I'm not quite sure. It's a really hard question.
I ask everyone that. Okay, Michael Maas, it's been a real pleasure talking to you.
Thank you for listening to the Luxury Insight and Fashion Network podcast. If you like this episode, subscribe to our channel to discover more exclusive insights from leaders of the industry. You can find all our episodes on luxuryinsight.com, social media, and wherever you listen to your podcasts.